A title that includes something very short about the Carefield Association, something about what we're doing now, and something about the new Flora project, which I know is what probably most people want to know about. And I noticed that we've also said possibilities. That could be anything, basically. We're hoping not to cause a fire or anything of that sort. So the Fairfield Association began in 1995, and that is our logo. And we were at that point saving green space, and the green space that we were concerned about was our local play area. Okay. So a very brief history of the organisation. And since 1996, we have raised around £500,000 for our various projects, which seems astonishing from this perspective. Well, it certainly would have been astonishing in 1996, and still seems astonishing now. We're equally proud of the fact that at the latest count the other day, we had 222 subscribing members, which also seems like a huge achievement. But we also, as well as those people, we also have lots and lots of people who do think, who maybe aren't subscribing members but do other things. One of the reasons for looking at our history is that some of the things that make us what we are have kind of come out of that history. And I think some of the things that we think are important to a sense of community, a sense of cooperation, a sense of self-sufficiency. So whenever we put a grant application in, I'm able to say we don't employ anybody, we do it all ourselves. So we are a volunteering organisation. So if we go to where we started, it's in 1995 when we uncovered, or somebody uncovered, plans for development actually on the play area. When we say on the play area, the plans actually involved a very tiny triangle of land on the play area and a set of derelict garages. The triangle of land was so small that it became known as the Bermuda Triangle because nobody was quite sure where it was. But nevertheless, it resulted in an organisation that really developed in opposition. There was a great head of steam at that point, and in November of that year, the Fairfield Association was formed. In 1996 we did quite a lot of things, but our main object was to buy these 10 derelict garages, and compared with the Flora project this seems like a very small ambition, but it was what we were all about at that time. We were in opposition, and I think we learnt from that to cooperate apart from anything else. So we learnt that if you're in opposition, then you're always watching your back, you're always trying to second guess what the other people are doing. If you cooperate, particularly with the people in authority, then you're much more likely to get somewhere. So in particular, we came up with a plan which helped the builder out, because the developer wanted his money for the garages, and it helped the council out, in that let them out of a rather tight and difficult situation. They had promised to sell this piece of land, the builder wanted his money, and we volunteered to buy the garages. Now, at that point, that was quite a good plan, but at that point we didn't have any money, and as we got to November 1996, the only money we had in non-restricted funds was £5,000, and the cost of the garages was £17,000. And so we had to, in a way we became bold, as I think we have become since then. We had to make a decision either to give up or to do something, and we went to the local community, which is what we've done on a number of occasions since then, and we said we could do with some money. In particular, we borrowed £12,000 from three people with no prospect really of paying it back, but we kind of assumed that they knew that they were unlikely to get it back. And in December 1996, we sent round a newsletter saying the Firthies Association now owns the garages. And there are the garages. So that was £17,000 worth of garages and a good deal more effort. Because we've been struck with a strap for cash, we've always been energetic fundraisers and energetic volunteers, and the volunteering is a big part of what we do. And as we go through here, you see other examples, more recent examples of people actually just getting out there and doing it. And so this is this was taking out the old play area and putting in the new play area. The problems we've had with money, I think, have made us very careful with money. We don't spend it unless we have to, and we try very hard to get it in from a funder or if we can. We have become excellent fundraisers because there's nothing like cutting your teeth on having to raise money for 10 derelict garages for making you quite good at the job. The Millennium Orchard is there because it's an example of the kind of serendipity that we have taken advantage of. The Millennium Orchard was never part of our plans, although it has become a great part of our organisation and almost like a jewel in the crown of what we do. So the Millennium Orchard, we applied to the Millennium Green in the hope of getting some money to pay back the people who had lent us the £12,000 to buy the garages. We had a grand overall project that included both the play area and the what has become the orchard. So there was like a very big green plan. But the Millennium Green people saw through us, and they said, well, we don't really think we're about play areas. And so that in 1999, in fact, we failed. In 1999, in fact, they came back to us and said, well, if you could put together a new and more creative plan to include the land that became the orchard but not the play area, then we would consider giving you the money. So, although that wasn't part of what we had thought of, we took the opportunity, and in the same way we've more recently taken the opportunity with the development along the canal, where the Triangle people came and said, would you be interested in becoming part of our project? And we said yes. In 2000, we had the Fairfield Community Orchard, and that's the vision that it came from. We've also always taken advice from experts, and our landscape architect, who has done most of the work for both the play area and the orchard and fauna, and will probably be involved in flora, could see that the picture on the right could come from the picture on the left. And the orchard made all sorts of things possible, and it made us able to flourish in other ways. So, for example, the orchard made the possibilities for community a lot larger. So it's a good setting for many community events. This one's the Easter egg hunt. We also have wassailing. We have Apple Day, and we have lots and lots of events in the orchard. So the orchard has proved a really good community base. More volunteers, Ian will recognise those. These are orchardiers at work doing the orchard. And here the orchard has also helped us to develop a kind of educational arm. So this piece of sculpture came from a cooperation with Dallas Road School, and we have close links with local schools. The plan for the talk is actually, once we've done the past, Mick's going to go on to look at the present. But before we do that, we have planned to take questions throughout, if anybody wants to ask them.
There are obviously lots of varieties of apples in the orchard. Nobody
yes.
seems to take the crab apples. What happens to those?
Okay, well, actually, it's a very good question to ask at precisely this moment because tomorrow we have a set of people coming from the Lancashire Environment Fund, and we had the apple press ready. And the person in our organisation who is most expert when it comes to apples and apple trees said to us, we were kind of we were worrying about where we're going to get the apples to go through the apple press. He said to us, why not use the crab apples? So at the moment we have a huge bag full of crab apples in the orchard that we will use
There's a particular variety of crab apple that is ripe already. Most of the apples in the orchard are not ripe, in spite of the fact that people have been picking them. But the John Downey crab apples are. They're those tiny red ones.
Yeah.
Pick one of those and eat it, it's delightful.
They're very beautiful anyway, aren't they? I mean, I think they're one of the most beautiful trees in the orchard.
About that idea, Linda, that the apples in David Carroll's that aren't doing is falling on the floor and rotting, they could be picked.
I thought I would go and talk to David about that. It's just that we haven't had time because we've been doing all this stuff.
When have you been them for?
Well, it would be nice to have some for Apple Day, which is on the 5th of October, isn't it? So
I'll have a word with him. I've had some of his damsons and mentioned, so.
Thank you. Yes, there are damsons in the orchard that need picking as well. Nobody seems to be taking a ladder down to pick them. They're up in the top of the trees.
Well, I have plans to do that tomorrow.
Okay, shall we, do you want to go on?
Yeah, sure. So, come round here because of the tape recorders there. We want to record the talks. So that they can go up on the website. So the next project that we've been involved in, which everybody will know about, is the Fauna Project, where we've basically taken 16 acres of land which we've leased from the City Council. It used to be owned by Robin Loxham. It used to be leased by Robin Loxham from the Council, and we now lease it from the Council. So let me orient it for you. Can do that. Here's the orchard here, and this is the footpath that runs around the edge of Fauna and out into Cromwell Road. You're not going to do this for me.
Sorry.
I can do it myself actually with this, it's okay.
Okay.
Actually, no, I can't.
Do you want me to go and do that?
Yeah. So this is Cromwell's Pond down near Cromwell Road. And the reason that we've got this slide here is because you can see some of the meadow flowers in the meadow area that we're trying to develop.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, the one that goes down. That's it. And there's one of the inhabitants. There'll be lots of red dragonflies around this year. Mm-hmm. They're very beautiful. We're very proud of them. So, as I said, Fauna is 16 acres. It was created about... In 2012, it's about 5 minutes walk from the railway station, which is amazing that we can have this green area so close to the centre of Lancaster. We raised about £130,000 to create Fauna. It took a lot of doing, putting in all of those piles and fences and so on. And we have the lease from the City Council at £1 a year for 30 years. After that, then we have to renegotiate it with them. We're hoping that by then they will feel that they won't be able to give it to anybody else. And we've created 8 ponds and pools, so we've made the area wetter. And the reason for that is because the most important thing about this area is that it is wetland property. Wetland birds need support, and it's particularly good for
birds like snipe and water roan. We've done various things to improve fauna, some of which you can begin to see. So we put in lots of new hedgerows, which are now beginning to grow. The reason we've done that, apart from the fact that we like hedges, is that they're very good for insect life, which of course the birds can then eat, and then eventually when the hedges get a bit bigger, the birds will be able to nest in them too. We've made a point of putting in quite a lot of fruiting trees in the hedge, so that there will be things for the wildlife to eat. We've also got this big area of lowland meadow and grassland where the white park are, and we're interested in reducing the fertility of that land. We're very lucky in that Robin Loxham had, unlike most other farmers, had not fertilised his land. So as a consequence, it's quite low in fertility, which is very useful in ecological terms. And in addition to the ponds that I've already mentioned, we're creating reed beds. You can't see those when you walk along the fauna footpath, but if you, as you're walking down towards Cromwell Road, if you look over the wildflower meadow area to the line of trees that are by the side of Lucy Brook, the willow trees, for example, there's an area beyond that, a triangular area, which is extremely wet. And we planted more than 1,000 reeds. Yes, did reeds, not rushes. I always get it the wrong way around. In there last year, and they are beginning to grow up, so we think that's working quite well, and that will gradually change that habitat. If we're really, really lucky, we might even eventually get... What are we getting now?
Bittern,
that's right, yes. In there. So that's really good. Okay, next one. One of the things that we need to do is to monitor what's happening in fauna, and indeed we're going to have to be doing this for flora too, and the orchard as well. That's partly because we're interested in it ourselves, but also partly because we have to justify some of the funding that we get for fauna and the orchard from Natural England. They gave us £20,000 roughly towards the capital cost of creating fauna. They also give us an annual amount every year to help us manage the area, which we'll have for 10 years in total. And so far we've had 2 years' worth. So we took baseline studies and we're now monitoring various things in fauna to see what's happening. And this is done via the Fauna and Orchard subgroup, locally known as FOG, which I think is a very good name for it. So we receive reports every month on what's going on in fauna and the orchard, what needs to be changed and so on. And in January of this year, one of the flush counts pulled up 2 moorhens, 2 pairs of mallard, 10 teal and 95 snipe. In that rushy area just opposite the orchard, it's full of snipe and you don't know they're there. And there is one. Just in case you haven't recognised one, that's what he looks like. Look for him. Most of them will be hidden, obviously, in the reeds. We've also got indicators of success going on in the wildflower meadows. Again, we receive reports on these, but these tend to be annual rather than monthly. We've done a lot of work, of course, removing ragwort from fauna. It's been going on for the last 2 years now. I can see Suzanne over there looking with a very stern look on her face because her husband Ian seems to be spending most of his time digging ragwort in the field. The first year we started digging ragwort out, we took out a volume of ragwort which was roughly equivalent to the size of a house. It was extraordinary how much ragwort was in there. It's now down to about 1%, something like that. It's a tiny amount now. We've been working at it consistently for the last 2 to 3 years. We've also been spreading wildflower seeds in the meadow. So what happens is that the cattle are kept out during the spring to summer period so that the grass can grow. It's then cut and we make hay, and some of you will probably have been involved in hay making. We do that every summer now. One of the reasons we do that is to reduce the fertility of the land. And the reason we want to do that is because wildflowers grow best on low fertility land, because otherwise they're having to compete with grass that grows too fast for them. And we are beginning to have success. We've had particularly good crops of yellow rattle this year. We put it in the year before for the first time. We had some come up in that spring, but it's done much better this year. But there are other wildflower seeds that are appearing as well, because we've been seeding it for the last couple of years. The cattle are allowed back in at the end of August, and they trample the seeds that we spread into the ground so that they can come up again in the spring. And Ian and his helpers have just sown 6 kilograms in there this year. That's much more than we've ever had before, so we're hoping that things will do well next year. There's a few people haymaking. People really like that. They volunteer to come along and do it. It's much harder to get them to come and pull weeds and cut out nettles, but they're very good at haymaking. So, that's all. Questions on that before we move on to floor?
Do you intend to leave some of the rattles?
Not if we can help it.
There are some caterpillars that feed.
Yes, I know.
Expensive.
Yes, I know. The problem, I mean, there's plenty of ragwort around. Ragwort is not in short supply. It's everywhere in the northwest. It's rampant.
Tell me about it. I've gotten a lot of it.
It's part of our agreement with Natural England that we get rid of the ragwort in the field. So it's actually something that we have to do. I think we would want to do it anyway. We think that we will, obviously there's an issue to do with the particular caterpillar that we're talking about, but we're hoping in general terms to replace the ragwort flowers with all these other flowers that we're growing, so we think that overall that would be beneficial. Any other questions?
Some of the pond areas seem to dry up quite a lot this summer. Did that have a detrimental effect on the wildflowers?
Not on the wildflowers, I mean, by
no,
and large.
No, on the flowers, the birds.
Well, I mean, obviously they have to cope with the fact that there isn't more wet, but we don't have an easy way of creating more, and it has to rain for that. But one of the reasons that we created the ponds and bunged up various land drains was to make the area wetter. It gets pretty wet in the winter, and it now stays wetter for longer in the summer. But of course this year it was a very long dry summer. We weren't here actually, we were in Germany, but we were told it was, and so it's bound to be the case that it will dry up then. And the birds just have to cope, they just have to find somewhere else. But they seem to manage.
Is there
an
issue with the land drying up? Was that the White Park cattle graze on some of this, and it maybe that they didn't why it's so hot and dry. So there's all sorts of, the whole ecosystem there is very integrated. Could I just mention the blog, if people spot anything themselves apart from the initial flushes?
Yes, that's a good idea. I mean, and we have up on the Fairfield Association website, many of you will know about it already, a blog where people can report what they've seen in fauna and the orchard, particularly wildlife, wildflowers and so on. So if you see things, do please report them, because it's part of how we collect the information about how we're doing on the various things. And we need, for example, to get the wildflower meadow going really pretty well by 2015, I think it is. It's part of one of our targets for our Natural England funding that we do that. So we're quite keen on knowing what's there. And we can't always see things ourselves, because we're not there all the time. You are probably there when we're not, and so that's very helpful for us.
Some of our friends who tried to establish wildflower meadows have found that it's more successful to use plugs of ready-grown plants. Have you considered that?
We haven't done that this time. We did use wildflower plugs when we created the orchard.
Yeah.
they still died off. Basically, the orchard area was so fertile that they couldn't compete with the nettles. And so we had hundreds of plugs in there, they all died. Except for, there's some little groups of primroses that are still there. Yes,
yes, this year we received a donation from the Friends of Historic Gardens of some primroses, particularly some other plant sizes, I can't remember. And we put them in the Oak Circle in the orchard, which is very much the fingers crossed.
Yeah.
But it would be nice next February to see a ring of primroses around the oak tree.
Yeah, we originally tried to grow wildflowers in that circle around the Millennium Oak, and in fact we planted right the way around it on the edge. Just about everything except the Cranesville has disappeared. They just couldn't compete with the grass, essentially. Mm. But we have now been, in effect, reducing the fertility of that area quite a lot over the last few years because we've been taking the hay off all the time as we cut it. So we're hoping that eventually we'll get wildflowers to warm there as well. Yeah, so let's move on. So what you're really here for, I'm sure, is to learn about flora. And this is the flora project. And we're going to talk about purchasing the land, what we're trying to do in terms of its conservation, how we're trying to enhance the land that we now have. It's 25.84 acres of fields and woodland that we have so far. There's another nearly 6 acres that we're in the process of buying but haven't managed yet. And I'll show that to you in a little while. The Heritage Lottery Fund has been very important for us in that it's given us £80,000 towards buying the fields that are going to become flora. And in addition to that, they've given us about £17,000, a little under that, for an educational project. Part of their remit, that what they want to do is to get people to learn about their heritage. And indeed, this lecture is part of that. So we'll talk about that as well. You need to. So this is flora. Those of you who came to the public consultation will have seen this map before. So let me just sort of take you through it so that you understand it. This red line is the public footpath that's coming down from the orchard. You know, when you come down that little hill after you've got to the end of the orchard, you drop down to Lucy Brook, which is along here. And this is where Fauna ends. And then the track goes up to Wallcliffe Road, like that. What we already own is this field here on the right hand side. If you're walking from Sunnyside Lane towards Wallcliffe Road, we own it more or less up to where the track widens out at the end, not quite but near enough. We own these fields too, the ones that are here called fields 3 and 4. We don't own this little field here, which is right on the corner of the track and Wallcliffe Road. That's owned, we think, by Wallcliffe Hall Estates. We do own this little triangular piece of wood here. This is the one that people are forever camping in, homeless camping in. And we also own Pony Wood on the top of the hill. The bit that we don't yet own, but it will be soon. They keep, the solicitors keep saying fortnight, but it's always another fortnight, but we'll get there eventually, is most of this field here, field 2. When we bought the land that we bought from the Harris family, we did actually buy a triangle of this field. They owned a triangle of it, that bit there. The rest of it is owned by the developers' leases. It was left over from the building of the Abraham Heights estate, which is up in here. It didn't get built on for some reason or other. They had it ever since. And effectively, we've now surrounded them because we have fauna here and flora here. So that bit of land is landlocked, so they can't use it for building. So they decided in the end that they would sell it to us. So, you'll have gathered from what I've said already that the flora fields, when we were trying to buy them, were in private ownership. We spent some time working on buying them. They cost us about £300,000. That's an enormous amount of money. And most of that money has actually come from people of banks. People have dug into their pockets and given us all sorts of money. We've had at one end £5 and at the other end £10,000 and every stop in between. The Heritage Lottery Fund money, which I referred to before, this £80,000 here, was what enabled us eventually to call in all of those offers of money that people had made. We felt that we couldn't take their money off them until we knew we could buy the land, and the reason for that was because once the money goes into a charity's bank account, it can't be given back. And we didn't want to take large amounts of money from people and then discover that we couldn't use it to do what they wanted us to do with it, and buy the land. So we had this kind of bizarre arrangement where everybody made promises, and we hoped that they kept their promises, and indeed they did. And when we got the Heritage Lottery Fund money, this £80,000, we knew then that we had enough. So we then called in all of the promises. It was remarkable. I think we only had one promise that didn't arrive. And there were something like 200 people who made promises. There were also other people who raised money in other ways for us by going on Morecambe Bay walks and things of that kind, raising sponsorship money. So it was an extraordinary community effort, and something I think that we can all be proud of. Sorry, let me come and do this one again. This is here to sort of show you our tactics. So let me show you this map. So here's the orchard. The green is fauna. And then this is what is becoming flora. We started off by buying this little purple strip of land. It's 2.5 acres. And it's right in the middle. We managed to persuade the National Association for the Care and Resettlement of Offenders that they could sell us that small piece of land. We said, well, you're a charity, we're a charity, why don't you sell it to us? And at first they were in a kind of consortium to buy it with everybody else who was involved, including Gleasons, the developers. It looked as if the whole area might well get developed. But this turned out to be a very important little strip of land for us. Some people here contributed to that, I know. Because what it did was to muck up the plans of the developers. At the point that they were selling the land, actually, they weren't selling this field here. So it looked as if we'd, in effect, stymied them entirely. But then this field came into play, which left them a way of building around our strip, so we were a bit worried about that for some time. But the attempt to sell the land didn't work, essentially because they had conditions on the purchase of the land which made it almost impossible for anybody except us to bid for it. We didn't bid enough, so we didn't get it first time round, but we kept on going, and eventually we managed to get enough money to do it. So, yeah, so escape, and then out of that, and then click on the corner. Now I think it's you again, isn't it?
Okay.
I'll carry on if you want me to. It's up to you.
No, I'm happy to do it. I've got everything there.
Okay, but so now we're going to talk about conserving. So it's Hilary's turn again. I'll play with the kit.
Okay. So when we put it in the lottery bid, then one of the things, because it's Heritage Heritage Lottery Fund, is that we undertook to conserve the local area. And actually this is a little bit more complex than you'd think, because there are all sorts of things that you could conserve in the area, and some of them are actually in competition with the others. So in particular, the area has a very rich history, and it also has a landscape that people very much value. So those are two things you would like to conserve. But there's also the wildlife along there is also in competition with both of those things. And recently, when we come to talk about the public consultation, you'll see that actually the landscape, the wildlife, and the need to increase the biodiversity and to conserve wildlife is somewhat in competition with history, because we found we've got lynchets in those fields. And there was a plan, there still is a plan, to turn them over to arable. Thank you. Okay. So these are some of the things that we think we have. We know we have lapwings, we know we have wading birds and brown hares. We don't have nesting lapwings, and one of our aims is perhaps to get nesting lapwings in the area. We've got wet and dry pasture, we've got old hedgerows which we hope to restore, and we have a historic woodland area. There is something, a small conflict there, because it is a part of the landscape that we would like to keep. It's a feature of the landscape with a well-defined shape on the hilltop. On the other hand, we're quite interested in planting some more trees. Our historical features, as I've said, include the lynchets, and the public footpath itself, is the remnant of what's said to be an old green road. So there are lots of things that you can conserve, and in some ways it's rather, it's a bit tricky to decide which ones you should go for. And there's an aerial view of the lynchets. We are in the process of finding out a bit more about those, so we have actually commissioned, and it's free as a charity, some better photographs so we can see where they are.
What
is the The lynchet is the
pointing at the ceiling.
Oh, sorry. Is that thing there?
No, that's the hedgerow.
Oh, sorry. The lynchet is just there.
What is it?
It's what happens when the land is ploughed, and it's ploughed in one direction over a number of years. Then.
No, that's ridge and furrow. Lynchets were flattened fields, and the farmers had to flatten the fields. It was a major earthquake, because they ploughed with teams of eight oxen. And to try to control eight oxen on a slope, was impossible. So they needed a flat field. So the oxen would go up and down. But ridge and furrow are rather different. That's where the plough turns the earth in a certain way and you get the furrow and the ridge. We don't have this.
Okay.
But they're essentially the visible remnants of medieval farming.
Farming.
Right?
Yeah.
They're strip farming.
Yes.
The most obvious inches are the ones on the ridge fields. They've been made more extreme over the years, but originally that was one of the ones on that terrace.
Yes.
You'll see them in the grammar school fields to the north of the former foot. They're very prominent there. It's like steps up the slight slope.
Yeah, I don't think we've got a photograph of them, have we?
Oh.
The lynching.
No. No.
Apart from the aerial photograph.
But yeah. You can see, if you look down here, you can see them in what is the Gleason's field, near Lucy Brook. And then they go up into the other fields too. We knew they were there in the Gleason's field and we wanted to protect them by having that area grazed. We thought it was all right to have arable crops in the other fields until we discovered at the public consultation that actually there were lynchets there too that we hadn't noticed.
Yes, it's okay.
Is this the moment to say that we're calling them lynchets? Nobody actually knows whether they were ploughed by teams of eight oxen, and they could have been strip farm of some kind, just divided up into different ownership, and terrace or wall or something like that. And for instance, it's interesting that the bit that came from Napro was probably worth about two of those lynching strips. Mm-hmm. But I think the actual history of them is something that's coming up in a couple of
years. It is, yes. Yes, we'll have to
will probably come and give an authoritative view about whether they are lynchets or ridge and furrow or ownership boundaries or what they are.
Yeah.
And, you know, we really don't know at this stage. Probably there's more research.
Yeah.
You know.
But yeah, I mean, the main thing is that they are the remains of the
earlier
farms, yes. Which we're interested in. Yeah. Okay, and this is just a picture of a lapwing of the kind we hope will nest in flora. Okay, so in terms of enhancing the area, we've got heritage cattle in there at the moment. We very much need more space for those heritage cattle. We see the heritage cattle in themselves as an enhancement for the area. We hope. In some of the fields that we take over, that we will have more of the ones we have already, and possibly other heritage cattle. We intend to increase the hedgerows, and there will be wide wildflower margins, so we hope again to encourage more wildflowers, a greater range of wildflowers. And that should help to encourage populations of insects and birds and mammals. We're in a very good position in terms of wet areas, so we intend to make the most of the wet areas that we have, and in the same way that we have done in fauna, we will scrape out some of the natural ponds that we have, seasonal ponds that we have for wetland birds and water-based mammals. The woodland area will be extended. It will be extended with some sensitivity to the landscape so that the outline of the wood on the top of the hill will remain. And the most controversial part of the plan, this is very good in terms of biodiversity because it's good for wildlife to have both arable and pasture and grazing. But we will have an arable crop in the spring to increase food and shelter for wildlife. it may not be a crop that pays any money, so but it will be a crop. So that some of those fields will become arable. And that's just a picture from the RSPB to show you what a wildflower margin could look like.
If we get it right.
If we get it right, yes. Okay. When we looked at this, then there seem to be, as I said, competing interests. One of them is the interest of people. So this is an environment that people have always enjoyed, the footpaths along there. And there is a case for saying that we should provide something, open up the area so that people can enjoy it even more. So Littlewood, the place where people tend to camp, we will open that up in a way so it becomes open access in a way similar to the way that the orchard is open access. So you will just be able to go in and you will be able to spray from the footpath in a way that you can't in Fauna, for example. The idea is to create a footpath around Ponywood and Littlewood so that people can enjoy the spectacular views from the top of the hill. Mm-hmm. So there are some wonderful views of the castle in particular once you get to the top of that hill. So there is a plan which Natural England are happy with to create a footpath up there. And we will assess the effects of these changes on the wildlife before putting in any other footpaths. So we aim to achieve a balance between people and wildlife and also the historical heritage. Okay, that's a picture of the castle from Ponywood. I don't know why, but we don't have a very good picture after all this of the castle from Ponywood, but I can assure you it's a spectacular view and well worth it. Okay. Okay, so are you going to do the public consultation?
Yeah.
So, we thought if we told you what the results of the public consultation were, which we had the weekend before last, and we can then tell you about the kind of decisions that we're making, partly as a consequence of that. So, first of all, we had in total most of them at the public consultation itself. Some of them came in during the next week or so. We had more from people. The stuff's up on the website. Other people emailed them to us. The Natural England plan for grazing the two fields, the Gleason's field and the one on the right hand side of the public footpath that I mentioned before, 133 people voted for that. out of 143 people. So we're going with that. It was what we wanted to do anyway, and people seem to approve of it. Similarly, for the arable areas, we had a good majority in favour of it, 119 out of 139. The numbers differ a little bit because sometimes people don't tick all the boxes on the questionnaires, so you get slightly odd results as a consequence of that. A fairly large majority also supported the extension of Ponywood, making it a bit bigger, 97 out of 132 people. And there was also a majority of support for opening up Littlewood, the little triangle that I was talking about before. So one person sort of voted in two directions at the same time, so we've got half numbers for this one. So it's 69.5 for open access, 40.5 for just a fence footpath through that area, and only 24 against any access at all. So what we've decided to do is to go for those proposals in the first instance. They also mainly supported the footpath that went around Ponywood and Littlewood, although the figures were not quite so clear for that. So there were 64 in favour of that footpath. There were 17 in favour of the footpath that went from Lucy Brook up to Pony Wood alongside the hedge line that we hoped to put in. There were 17 that wanted the path that went across from the top of Pony Wood to Aucliffe Road, more or less opposite where Harrogate's Bridge is. Okay. The complication was that 32 people said they would like combinations of two of those footpaths. So if you add all those together and compare them with the 64, the figures are not quite so good. But we decided in the end that we would go for the path that goes around Pony Wood because it's the least intrusive of the footpath designs that we have in relationship to the wildlife. It's the one that Natural England wanted us to go for anyway, so that helps us because we get funding from them. The Natural England agreement, which was 10 years for fauna, will only be 8 years for flora because we have to latch on to the agreement that we already have. And indeed, we have to have our bid in by the beginning of October, by the 1st of October, which is why we've been rushing through the public consultation. I think we wouldn't have had it for a few more months yet if we could have been a bit more leisurely about it. But the idea then also is that we can see how it goes, and if that works, and we think we can manage to extend the footpath system a bit in a few years' time, then we could do that after the end of the Natural England Agreement. I personally am kind of hoping that that won't happen. I would have preferred there to be no footpath paths at all. I'm a wildlife man. Okay. So, in general then, the public consultation also supported the Natural England proposals. There was a question at the end of the consultation asking whether people were generally in favour or not. 99 said they were, 6 said they weren't, and 23 said they kind of were mostly, but there were some bits they didn't like. The public consultation raised some issues, and Hilary's referred to some of them already. So there's this business of the lynchets in fields 3 and 4. There's an issue to do with the use of herbicide and fungicide on the fields, and there's an issue to do with the existence of a public right of way. So I'll take those one at a time and explain what we've done since the public consultation and what that is leading us towards. So, first of all, the lynchets then. We have that aerial photograph that you saw before. We asked for another photograph to be taken which is much more detailed from the air, and that is in process at the moment. It's probably the case that they're going to have to send up an aeroplane to take the photo, so it could be a bit before we get it, but what that will do is will give us more detail so that we can understand a bit better how the lynchets work, what might be underneath them, and so on. We were talking to an organic farmer this afternoon, a man called Bill Grayson from Silverdale, about the lynchets and also about the use of herbicide and fungicide, because the farmer that we'd been put in touch with to create the arable land said that he wanted to spray it with herbicide and fungicide before he put the crops on. And this was something that people objected to at the consultation. Bill Grayson, who is an organic farmer, says that it is possible actually to grow the crops that we want without herbicide or fungicide. We won't get such large crops, but it can still be done. And given that our major concern is not selling the crop, but producing things that are going to be good for the wildlife, we're going to go with that and see what happens. We can use our Natural England funding to help us do that over the next few years. And he's also come up with an interesting suggestion for being able to farm the lynchets in a way that would make some sense. So he's saying, well, what you could do is to plough each flat line parallel to the line, not plough the edge of it, and you could then use the sort of system of shapes that you would have as a way of growing different kinds of things. So in addition to the arable crop, we want to have wildflower patches in the meadow, and we also want to have patches of plants that are going to produce good seeds for birds. So we would end up with a kind of variegated set of strips we're hoping for that will be different colours and so on. So that's what we're hoping to go for. We need to do more research on this to make sure that what's being proposed is not going to damage the limpets. So we have to be careful about that, but we are telling Natural England that we want to go with their proposals, but subject to the kinds of conditions that we just talked about. The last thing I should mention is this business about the possible existence of a public right of way. A number of you will know that some people over the years have sort of gone over the fence at where the footpath comes down from the orchard to Lucy Brook and then Doglegs. People have been climbing over the fence there, walking across the fields and then going out of the field on Alcliffe Road, very close to on the opposite side of the road from Cabarets Bridge. And so it was claimed that there was a public right of way there. I've been in touch with Lancashire County Council. They've looked it up on their definitive maps. There is no public right of way across there, although it is the case that people have sometimes walked across that area. So we're going to go ahead and develop the land in the kind of way that we've been proposing.
I think, Nick, if you make sure that it's closed off and publicly closed off with notices at least one day a year, then it can't be claimed as a
footpath.
Something similar to that, that you advertise it locally and make sure it stays shut.
Yeah, I mean, clearly there's an issue of that sort, isn't it? Sorry. So you can now see a bit better what we were planning to do. So these are the fields that we want to turn into arable. Ponywood is here, it's light green colour. The darker green is the bit that we want to extend.
Will they be smaller trees, Nick?
Well, we've taken your suggestion into account already. We've been talking about that and we'll try and do that. Yeah. Probably even small trees turn out to be taller.
Quite a nice view up from the path.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But even small trees turn out to be taller than human beings, so it may be that it doesn't have to work forever. But we'll certainly try. The public right of way that I was talking about basically is from here that people were worrying about, goes up across and comes out there. Mm-hmm. But as far as we can see, there is no actual evidence for it. The other thing to take care of with John's point that we're considering doing, and we don't know whether people will like this or not, and we will have to ask them first, we were thinking in terms of improving the public footpath up through there. We now, in effect, own this patch. Mm-hmm. There's an issue about this patch here, which somebody else owns. And one possibility would be to try and widen that footpath out so that it became wheelchair accessible. Some of us...
Cycle path,
isn't
it?
Sorry?
It's already used as a cycle path, even though
it's...
Yeah. Yes, and I think you're probably never going to stop that. So, but there are issues about, in effect, widening the path, because you'll have to cut away a little bit of the lower part of the banks to do that,
yeah,
and that might then affect the wildflowers. So we have to be careful about that. I've got a meeting on Monday at 9:30 with a footpath person from the council, county council. We're going to look into that. And so we may well be coming back to you all at some point, asking you for your opinion about what to do with the footpath.
Create a new path alongside of it, would that not be cheaper? Leave that part or grow something over it, let it just grow.
We create
a path on the side of the field that you own.
We'd prefer not to do that because of the effects on the wildlife. You then have to grow the hedge up, and in the meantime, everybody's going to be walking up and down it. It's going to disturb the wildlife, so we're not particularly keen on doing that. Can you come out of that? Yeah, and then close it. Yeah, and then on. Just click on again. Now let's just talk a little bit about the learning. We're obviously interested in helping people understand about the nature reserve, its purposes, its heritage, and that's what we're going to use the Heritage Lottery Fund for. And there are three elements to that. So first of all, there's a schools program. The team of people that are doing this are going to go into local schools, mainly local primary schools. They've got six signed up so far, they're hoping for eight. And they will end up going into those schools and doing work with them, sometimes in the school, sometimes outside, in floor itself, for half-day sessions over the year. And they're being planned at the moment and will start reasonably soon and will carry on through till next summer term. Clearly it makes more sense to go out into the fields with small children in the summer than in the winter. We've also got a programme to do with volunteer training. The Heritage Lottery Fund have given us some funds to buy more tools for our volunteers, which is very useful for us. We've got a lot of extra work that's going to need to be done. And we're also using that money to do volunteer training. So in November, four of our volunteers are going to go on a chainsaw training course. Which is some days long.
Four days long.
Yeah. So four people for 4 days, and you can imagine that's quite a lot of money. But we will also be doing other training for volunteers, and not just that four, but any other volunteers who want to come along. So there'll be hedge laying, for example, and what else have you got?
Poor people with chainsaws, aren't they? Loose on there.
Well, poor trained people with chainsaws, and only those four.
It all seems a bit excessive.
Well, but
it so happened that the training company just provided a course for the maximum of four people, so we paid for the course.
So there's no point in not having four people for it.
And the main use of the chainsaw is for head work, not for felling trees.
No. And then, of course, the last element of the educational programme that we're using the Heritage Lottery Fund for is this series of talks. And that's why you had the rather boring one to begin with, where we tell you about things you already know. It's meant to be a kind of introduction to what comes next. You're not doing the map offshore, okay. I guess Mike Derbyshire will do maps anyway when he's here. But our last slide really has to do with the support that we think we might be able to get from you. Some of you will already be members of the Fairfield Association. If you're not, it really helps us if you join. It doesn't help us very much financially because it doesn't cost much to join, but it's very good when we're applying for funds. To say that we now have more than 200 members of this little charity is extraordinarily good when we're trying to persuade people to give us money. You can become a volunteer. We always need more volunteers, and we need more than ever now because we've got so much land that we're going to have to go with. And of course we need more money because sometimes we won't be able to do all the work ourselves. We'll have to get a contractor in to do something or other. So we're interested in donations, and please think about mentioning us in your will. I've been asking them all the way along, so you probably don't have any, but we're willing to take questions if you have any.
Can you give us any idea of which varieties of trees would be planted?
We haven't really talked about it in that kind of detail yet. We've been scrambling to get through to the position we're in, and that will be the next thing to consider. We've had some donations offered to us already of trees, and Ian has applied for a set of trees from the Woodland Trust. Over the last few years we've got 420 trees a year from the Woodland Trust. We use quite a lot of them for hedging, trees that are appropriate for hedging.
changing the colour of hawthorn and other fruiting trees. But what have you applied for this year?
Well, the application went in 3 months ago, and I can't remember the details, but it is for a selection of woodland plants rather than hedgerow plants. But I'm afraid I can't remember the detail.
But that is something that we need, you know, to discuss and think harder about. And if anybody has suggestions, we'd be, you know, more than happy to take them into account. There will also need to be some management of pony wood. And there are some trees in there that are in, you know, a bit of a state, and we need to decide what to do with them. One possibility is just to leave them. Another possibility is to, you know, manage them in some way, and we have to consider that. So those kind of details we just haven't got to yet in our planning. It's taken so much time and effort raising money and then trying to get flora off the ground, that it's going to take us a bit, I think, before we get into that kind of detail.
We do have a general policy of planting, you know, native species, and we also, whenever we've done anything, we've also had a landscape architect who has a good sense of how it's going to look when it's on the ground to help us, and we found that very useful.
Are you planning to make a formal viewpoint at the top of the
We had talked about having a bench up there. I don't think we talked about much more than that. I mean, are you thinking in terms of one of those things that sort of points you into, you know, towards that and that?
Well,
or something?
Possibly.
Yeah. I mean, we hadn't considered that, but again, I mean, we'd be open to thinking about it. We have to be a bit careful about taking the wildlife into account too. So you don't want to sort of create things where you have, you know, lots and lots of people up on the top of the hill all the time. So it's kind of nicer for the wildlife if they just, you know, carry on moving around. But you know, it's not something that we thought about, but yes, we could do that.
I was just
going
to say, on the back to the woodland, the wood that was planted in 1830 included, this native species, this included one or two things like sweet chestnuts as well. And I think it might be quite nice to think about whether we could plant more of those, and, you know, sort of landscape trees that might have been planted 150 years ago, as well as conventional native species. But, I mean, that's something we could sort of list for discussion.
Yeah. And we also have to consider the effects of different kinds of trees. So one of the things that happens, for example, if you plant beech, is that you don't get anything growing under them. They're lovely trees in themselves, but if you want to have things growing under the trees, then they're not a very good tree for that kind of thing. So we have to work out some policies on that, and we are open to suggestion and discussion. As many of you will know, I mean, all our meetings are open, anybody can come along. You know, we're more than happy to take suggestions from people. We don't consider ourselves to be experts. On the contrary, we're usually struggling to cope with our own bits of knowledge.
My question prompted by the map that you showed the natural land.
Mm-hmm.
And I noticed that the field just to the north of the former path, which we call the grammar school field, it's owned by the grammar school, it has plain fields written across it. Have you any ideas to what the grammar school might have in mind for the for those fields? Because just up the hill, they put down.
We know some of the history of their discussions and lack of decision making. And we're very pleased about their lack of decision making, because the longer it stays as it looks, the better. Their original idea was to cut the top off the hill, flatten it, and to have, you know, sports pitches and a running track around it, so they needed it to be flat for that. Luckily for us, I think they then began to realise that there were issues to do with that, particularly in terms of cost. And they don't have the kind of money that would support that. So they haven't gone down that line as yet. implication is that Ofsted has told them that they should have more playing fields than just the playing field they use at the moment. So they will certainly want to have some playing field kind of activity on there. Since the first idea was mooted, the sports teacher in the drama school has changed, and the new one has different ideas. And that's part of the issue, that as the staff change, the ideas change, and we never quite know what's going to happen. But the last idea that we heard of was that the land and its shape was going to be left roughly as it is now, and they were thinking in terms of putting sort of kind of outward bound kind of equipment on it, you know, so the girls would be able to climb up over nets and things like that. Again, whether that will actually happen, I don't know. It's a couple of years since we last heard of them doing anything, and we're sort of keeping quiet at the moment. We don't want to sort of have them spring to action again if we can help it. But it's very difficult to know. Schools aren't open organisations in the kind of way that the Fairfield Association is, so they could be talking about this and making decisions about things, and we just wouldn't know about them unless they chose to tell us. We did have a lot of contacts with people in the school, and we obviously keep an ear open in the hope of finding out what's happening. But as far as I know, there's nothing particular for them at the moment.
I think that the only thing I could add to that, for some of them, is that I think the Ofsted requirement to have more playing fields was linked to the previous government's targets for so many playing fields per child or something, and the present government has abolished those targets, so they don't apply any longer, and Ofsted probably wouldn't insist on it. And also, it seems as if they've moved from, they've moved from saying we ought to have more playing fields to saying, well, actually, the point of having that land was it was next to us and it seemed sensible for us to own it, so we own it, and that's probably what we need to do at the moment. And we always need more buildings, teaching space, more desperately than we need sports places. So I think it might stay the way it is for quite a long time. I wouldn't be surprised if one day they ask the Fairfield Association who'd like to buy it.
Any other questions? Yes?
I think this would give you an idea, a massive deer in the fight. Are there any fighting with deer?
Deer roam the area, and occasionally they turn up in corners. And actually I have seen deer on the public footpath right at the bottom of Sunnyside Lane, and they definitely have been in the orchard. In fact, they stripped the bark off a couple of trees. They wander around the area, so I mean they tend to use the canal as a kind of corridor. I've seen them when I walk into the university along the canal. I've sometimes seen them on the other side of the canal going along the top.
And the frequency was?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So they're around, and just that you never know when they're going to appear. But they are around, and of course, you know, they can jump fences and things without any
trouble.
The
little
roe
deer. Yeah. Mm-hmm. The other question I'm going to ask you, based on something I thought about 8 years ago when I was walking over Hambrook Bridge and just looking to the right, and I don't know if it was particularly wet and marshy there, but 30, 40, 50 kind of herons swooping on the, you know, frogs. And I wondered if I don't know how big this is, but I imagine that it's like that if you know friendly. Are they a threat? You'd be trying to keep those out because they're a threat to a species, or would you encourage them?
Well, I think our general view is that we shouldn't be trying to control them, we should just be letting them and all the other wild creatures do their own thing, and if that involves eating one another, then that's what we do. We had quite a long debate not so long ago over some foxes that were in the South Hole, and the foxes were eating some of the wild duck, of course. And so some people got rather uptight about that, and wanted us to go in there and execute the foxes. But we talked about it and we decided that we could just let the foxes do what they do, because the foxes have to eat just like everything else does, and the same is true for the herons, I think.
Would you say the same thing about
mink?
I prefer the mink now to be there, and one of the difficulties with the mink, of course, is that if you don't control them, then they do pretty terrible things to water voles in particular.
Yes.
And we would be quite keen on getting water voles in flora if we could. So, but I don't think we're going to be out trying to control mink. We might support other agencies that do that, but I don't think we're not going mink hunting, as far as I know. Nobody ever suggested that we should do that. I suspect I'd be rather bad at mink hunting.
Frozen toads? Extra activity for them.
Hope nobody's advertising your relaxed views than Canada geese.
or grey squirrels. We both curse about them.
Frogs and toads. Frogs and toads. And they've been there are fair numbers.
You see them quite a lot in the orchard, actually. In the long grass in the orchard, they're around.
We've lived on around Max now for 12 years. Mm-hmm. In the garden, I put an old series of research legend ponds in the pot. And for several years, it was fine. And the frogs would move here. So every year, we get hundreds of tadpoles. And little frogs spreading out all over the place. And we do.
Yes, and certainly Sid has. I mean, he's forming back on.
Put 40 toads in the little brook down in the pond.
They're in there, and you just have to find them. Any other questions? Perhaps we can end it there then, but I hope that you would want to come and listen to some more of the talks which will abound in more edifying in this one.
Thank you very much to Rick and Hilary for starting us off with this room and painting in the background so well. And some of it I've heard before, but every time I listen to you speak, there are things that I hadn't known about the Fairfield Station.
Okay.
So thank you very much for that. I'd like to encourage you to come along to our next talk. Bill Grayson was referred to earlier, he's a great friend of Fairfield, and a great friend of mine, and he's